Okay, testing 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4.
Can you give a description of what the Sacagawea Hotel may have looked like on the inside?
Okay, of course the radio station at that time was located on the mezzanine, and I remember when we were out on the highway and we're going to move downtown, and I thought at the time, how in the world are we going to have a radio station on the mezzanine? It just didn't seem big enough. But it's like a lot of things, when you build, the more you build, the bigger it gets. And it worked out very well. They put up glass walls, windows. And we had a studio and a control room and the newsroom and a record room, which had tons of records back in the good old days, the 78s, this type of thing, and 45s. We had more 45s by then. But we liked it so well because we could see anything that's going on down in the lobby. We overlooked the lobby. And whenever anybody important came to town, they always stayed at the SAC. And we had a full view of them. And most of the time, we were able to get them and interview them on the air, you know. And one time when they made the movie, Pillars of the Sky here, Jeff Chandler was here. And I can't even think of the rest of them now, the rest of their names, Ward Bond. But anyway, they spent a lot of time at the radio station. But I remember just so much activity going on down in the lobby. If anything important was happening in town, it happened at the SAC. And I remember upstairs, on the same floor we were on the mezzanine, they had a small ballroom and a large ballroom for dances and meetings. Lions Club, Kiwanis, a lot of those met in a small ballroom. But I do remember one time Frankie Carl and his orchestra were here. And that doesn't mean beans to you. You don't even know who Frankie Carl was, do you?
No.
Well, he was a big orchestra back in those days. And he and his orchestra were in the large ballroom and had a big crowd up there for that.
What did it look like in the large ballroom?
It was nothing really spectacular. It was just like a big lodge hall is what it was. You know, just chairs. No special chandeliers or anything like that. You know, you'd think there might be. But
do you remember the coloring of the carpets?
Well, of course, it was bare floor. There was no carpeting.
Oh, bare floor.
It was bare floor, both this large and small ballroom. But there was just all kinds of activity. Something was always going on in either one of those two ballrooms. And, of course, in the upstairs, it was 7 stories high, and rooms were very adequate. And we had the elevator, had only one elevator, and it was always in working condition, as I remember.
Were there also stairs?
Yes, there was a pretty neat stairway. Nothing really outstanding, but it was kind of neat, kind of about a half circular stairway that came from the lobby up to the mezzanine. So that was kind of neat.
Did it have a wooden banister? Or?
Yes, yes. And I do remember when they decided that the hotel was going to go and they were going to tear it down, they had kind of a real special type party where they gave away dishes and glasses, you know, and a lot of people still have those as souvenirs.
What did those look like?
But, they had the picture of Sacagawea on them, you know, Indian painting. Mm-hmm. And this magnificent picture of Sacagawea is now hanging in the U.S. Bank. They saved that, thank goodness. That was really a magnificent picture. But, and then next to it, of course, was the SAC Annex, which is still standing. But at that time, one of the things I remember about that was back in the good old days, we had the Ground Observer Corps, which was a series of volunteers working with the Air Force to spot planes or keep track of aircraft. And we had our post on top of the SAC Annex up there. And we had private phone lines into headquarters that we could phone in airplanes coming over, and we had to sight them and tell what kind they were. But
the purpose of that? What were you looking for?
Well, it was during the Cold War, you know, type thing, and they just wanted to keep track of aircraft. And it, Ground Observer Corps was a nationwide thing. I mean, they were everywhere. But it was volunteers that volunteered to go up and keep track of those all day long.
24 hours a day?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was quite a thing. But the thing I remember the most about it, I guess, is that sometimes we didn't have the elevator. We had to walk up 7 flights to get to the roof.
Why didn't you have the elevator?
I don't really remember now. I just, maybe we were younger and just wanted to get the exercise. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But I thought, oh, that's a long ways up there, 7 flights. I couldn't begin to do that now. But that was such fun. And I don't remember how long that lasted or when it ended. But it was, speaking of, you know, community events and things, that was also one of the big things, was being in the Ground Observer Corps. And you worked directly with the Air Force. And it was volunteer. You didn't get paid for it. But
how many volunteers do you think that there were?
Oh, I'm guessing there. I imagine we probably had, 30.
Wow.
Yeah, there were quite a few, both men and women, you know, around town. But I just remember so much activity going on between the SAC Annex and the Sacagawea Hotel. And, of course, it had the coffee shop and the Sage and Sand Room, which was the bar and lounge, was downstairs.
Do you recall what the coffee shop looked like?
Well, just like a restaurant. The color green comes to mind, like green walls and... But it was just your typical coffee shop, you know. It had really good food. It was neat. Everybody ate there. Well, not everybody, but when you went out and do something special, you know, there weren't a lot of specialty places to go in those days. And the SAC coffee shop was one of them. But it was just so neat to be part of that. And I do remember one thing about the SAC hotel adjacent to the radio station. When we could climb out the windows of the studio and be on the marquee, and we could sit out there and broadcast parades and stuff that went by.
Mm-hmm.
So that worked out pretty good. So it was a really a fun place.
So how big was the radio station then?
Well, let's see. I think we had finally gone 1,000 watts up there. And that was a lot for us. I mean, at that time, we were the only station in town. Didn't have the college station yet, and I'm not even sure if FM had been invented. I'm sure it had, but we didn't have it at that time. And we were remote. Our tower was way out on Cove Avenue, so everything went out there on telephone lines. That was back before satellites, so everything was ground lines. But, and we were into everything. I mean, we covered elections. If it was news, we were in it, or on it, you know. We were just a part of the community. Much more, I think, than some stations are now. It's not quite as convenient, I guess, maybe with the satellite systems, to have as much localized information as we had then.
Mm-hmm.
But it was really great. It was a great time, I'll tell you.
You mentioned before in an earlier interview that you were nervous on that first day of work.
Terrified might be a better word.
Can you describe for me the working conditions on that first day? You know, did you use headphones? Tell me about some of the equipment that would have been involved.
Well, the equipment we had was a console, and I mentioned, I think, earlier, the 45 record player, which was kind of a homemade thing that our engineer had put together. And I think at the most we probably had 30 to 40, 45 records.
And what are 45 records?
Well,
just in case I didn't know.
Oh, yeah. Well, they're about, I guess, 7 inches in diameter, and they had a a hole in the middle of them that fit down over a holder, whatever you called it, you know. And the 78s were a little bit bigger. They were about like a dinner plate, the 78s. And then we had what were called electrical transcriptions, and they were big dudes. They were about 16 inches. They were like just a huge big platter, you know. We had a few of those. But
how many songs would that hold?
Oh, I think there were like maybe 8 to a side on the ETs. And, of course, the 45 is just one song per side.
And the 78?
And 78's one song per side.
So why were the 78s larger but still only had one song?
I really don't know. I guess because they were invented first.
Okay.
Before the 45s. And now we have, as you know, CDs and stuff like this, you know, which were unheard of back in those days. Couldn't even spell CD then. But I do remember looking back at it now, it really looked pretty snazzy to me, but it was pretty antiquated equipment compared to what we have now.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, just progress just improved things so much, but it was plenty adequate. We were able to do what we were there to do, you know, play songs, do the news, interviews, community entertainment. And at that time, we were the only station, so we had a lot of responsibilities.
So what was the significance of radio at that time?
Well, I suppose the spontaneity of it, being able to be on the spot and get information out compared to printed matter. The observer was always an important... the phone rang while we were trying to do this, and I forgot what we were talking about.
We're talking about the significance of radio
and yes,
time to
yes.
The community.
Now, as I did mention, we did have the Observer, which was a big part of the community as far as advertising and information. Between the Observer and the radio station, that was where people got their news. We hadn't, television hadn't come into the valley yet at that time, so we didn't have the benefit of television, but we did have, of course, the Oregonian and the bigger newspapers were in here. But the main thing was that we were just the hub of the community. If there was anything going on, we just felt responsible that we had to report it or tell people about it, you know. And I remember elections, we'd be on the air all night, you know, waiting for the election results to come in. And people relied on that. Here again, a responsibility to perform that duty, which we gladly did. So I think the main thing is just after I had been here a while and realized what an important thing it was to be in a community, to be in a position at a radio station to fulfill entertainment and information. And again, I use the word responsibility, but that's exactly what it was. And of course, that's what the FCC, Federal Communications Commission, wanted stations to do, was perform community service.
More so than entertainment.
Well, about as much, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They knew it was an entertainment medium, but then they also knew that it was viable communication access to keep the public informed of what was going on.
Do you feel that radio during that time helped to keep the community together?
Oh, I'm sure. Oh, yes, I'm sure it is. You bet. Not only here, but I mean any small community, or even the larger ones. But Baker, Enterprise, the smaller communities, Ontario, all had their radio station, you know, and only one at the time in each community. So I'm sure that... It helped hold everybody together, kept us informed.
Mm-hmm. You also mentioned previously something about cartridges. I'm not sure if we covered that completely. What exactly is a cartridge?
Okay, cartridges. gee whiz, do you remember 8-tracks at all?
Yes, I do.
Yourself? Okay. Well, they're kind of like the 8-tracks, only cartridges came first. And it was where you could record music or we used them a lot for commercials. But I remember when they first came out, I think Baker got them before we did. And I thought, why in the world would any self-respecting radio station want to have cartridges? You know, I couldn't see any purpose to them at all. And then finally we did get them. And then I thought, how'd we ever exist without them? You know, because they were so, you could have a whole bunch of them lined up and have a whole bunch of commercials and just instantly hit the on button and they play, you know. And instead, as opposed to using live copy, you know, before that we read everything live, news and commercials. So the cartridges really filled a big void. And you could have sound effects, you could do a lot of things with them that you couldn't do with live stuff.
How did that change the order of your working day when cartridges came along?
Well, it simplified it a great deal, you bet. And made it a lot easier. And that way you could have different voices too, because other people on the staff could record commercials. So people didn't have to listen to one guy, you know, for 5 or 6 hours straight. So it made a lot more variety.
Did your hours increase?
Not really, no. The hours stayed about the same per shift.
So when would you do the recording and when would you do the live?
Well, you do the recording when you were off the board shift, you know. Do it later.
And what is the board shift?
Well, on the air.
Okay.
That's what they call being on the board. But most of that was done after you got off of that work. Or somebody else. Sometimes we just had people and that's all they did was do commercials. You know, type the copy and then record them. So it tended a lot of times to increase your staff because you had more people involved in doing these things.
Can you take me through a typical work day? As far as the order of what would happen?
Okay, as best as I can remember, the first thing, of course, and for many, many years, I signed on the station. This is way back before 24 hours. We were on the air like from 6 in the morning until 11 at night.
And what do you mean by sign on the station?
Well, to turn everything on and go on the air and make the announcement that this is KLVM or whatever station it is, you know. Broadcasting on what frequencies and da 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 da. And then the first thing you did usually a newscast live, or in the days when we finally went to the network, then we would go on the air with ABC News first. And then from there into commercials and music, and then along about 7 or so, then we would go into the local news, cover it pretty well. And then we had special programming. The Trading Post, I remember, was one where people could buy and sell merchandise or things, you know. Kind of like a yard sale on the air is what it was, pretty much. And then throughout the whole shift, the rest of the day was, sometimes there would be interviews, like at 10:30 was a special time to have a 15-minute interview.
Do you recall what that was called?
Well, they varied, different programs, and no, I don't remember now. Gee whiz, how soon we forget.
Mm-hmm.
But they did have special names, and of course our news director, Bob Mask, was the one that was pretty much in charge of setting up these interviews. If it was during elections, he'd have candidates on the air, you know. If it was a school election, they would talk about the school issues, this type of thing. And then here again, then back to more music and weather. And then my shift ended at 11:30. So then they would do much the same thing. Of course, the noon hour was almost always devoted to news, either network or local, Northwest news, farm news, you know, whatever. If it was newsy, that's when you heard it from 12 to 1. And then it was just, the rest of the day was just pretty much music and commercials and trivial information, you know. Back in those days, the DJs didn't yak it up all that much. I guess maybe we hadn't learned to do that yet. We relied pretty heavily on music and this type of thing.
You had also mentioned writing in requests as opposed to calling in requests. And what was the difference in those? Why the two different?
Well, if they would write, now like the request hour, we had that too. But if they had anything special they wanted to know, it was a lot easier if they would write it and send us a letter that we could respond to.
Was that because it took longer to find the record they may be looking for? Or?
Well, that would be involved, and you just didn't have the time to necessarily go get it right then unless you knew right where it was,
okay.
Which wasn't always the case because you had many, many hundreds of records to go through. But it was just easier if they would send a letter and request it in writing, you know. And then we could respond to that letter on the air before we played the song or whatever.
So were the letters specifically for requests for music, or was it also a request for other types of information?
Well, mostly for the music, for the request hour. But a lot of times we got letters, people requesting information on people or things, you know, the community. Not so much that we'd need to answer it right away on the air. It's just that they were curious about having us check into this and do some investigative reporting, I guess, is what they call it now.
And those who were using the phone to call in, were they the same, just requesting music, or were they requesting other information?
Oh, It'd be both.
You had a little bit of a problem with some of the lyrics that were coming out on some of the music, and you said that you wrote to Nashville about this.
Oh, yeah, early on.
What made you write to Nashville?
Well, I don't know. I was really very new in the game, and it seemed like all this country western music, which I wasn't into at the time, seemed to be about divorce or drinking or... My mother got ran over by a truck, or, you know, these crazy things. But primarily, the one that really got to me the most was these triangles, you know. And I thought, why do we have to have all this music about these sordid love affairs and stuff like that? You know, I thought, can't you write music about something else besides that? And so I wrote a letter to Nashville. And I don't know if I got a response. I can't remember. Probably not.
To someone specific in Nashville, or?
No, just whatever. I can't remember now.
Okay.
But just one of the record, probably one of the major recording studios, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I just thought, oh my goodness, can't they come up with something else? And they're still doing it, you know. They still are.
Mm-hmm.
Only it's better. It's worse now. It's on movies,
mm-hmm.
you know, on TV and stuff.
So what did you feel your role as a DJ was when it relating to the taste of people's music?
Well, I felt, here again the word responsibility comes in, to keep people informed and entertained, and to set an example as such. So that's why in those days we were very careful with the language we used. You know, there was no swearing and foul language on there at all. It was unheard of. So we just had to make sure that we complied with that and could set good examples, because we knew a lot of the kids, the young kids, were listening, and a lot of times would come and visit the station just to watch, especially when we were in the hotel up on the mezzanine. They'd be up there standing on the mezzanine, leaning over the rail, watching us behind glass in there, you know. So we just knew that we had to mind our P's and Q's and be careful of what we were doing.
So how did that affect the selection of music that you may have played?
Well, that had a big factor. Of course, most of the music that we had to choose from was okay, you know, no big problem. Because they're I can't even think of any records that that we could not play in those days. You just didn't have, because there was no problem there. There was no foul language or anything like that, you know.
So you were able to play a variety of music from country to
you bet.
Rock and roll?
We covered it all. I wasn't too big in rock, but I probably played a few that were a little borderline. I was not a rock and roll fan.
How many DJs were there at that point?
Let's see, I think we had five on the staff.
So I would imagine the selection varied from DJ to DJ.
The night guy was into rock. Of course, that's when the kids were all listening and stuff, you know. So we primarily had the younger guys at night that could keep up with it, you know.
Why do you think broadcasters would choose a small place like La Grande when radio wasn't everywhere?
Well, actually, a station is selected by local people that get together and raise the funds or whatever it is to build a radio station. And they have to apply for a license and this type of thing. But if they see a need in a community, as they did here, that, I mean, we were at that time, you know, 10,000, which is pretty good size. So they just felt that there was a reason for a station to be here and enough businesses involved to pay for it, you know, that they could make money. That's the main thing
they
want to do.
Through advertising?
Yes, you bet, absolutely. So they figured if a community was big enough and had enough business going on and enough people that would be interested in having a communication device, that's what they would do. So it's individuals that decide to build a station, you know, big or small.
Mm-hmm.
It takes investors.
Okay. The radio station moved from the SAC Hotel, correct me if I'm wrong.
Yes.
Then it moved to another location and then back into the SAC Hotel.
No, way back, I guess at one time, they were located in the SAC Hotel. In one of the back rooms upstairs. Now, I don't remember that for a fact, but I've heard it said that that's where they started. Then they moved out onto the highway, like on Highway 30 going out of town, like to Baker, about a mile out of town. We were located there in a house. And then in 1955, then we moved into the SAC Hotel downtown. And we were there until, I think it was 1970, when they decided they were going to tear down the hotel. So we had to find someplace else. And we already had the tower out on Cove Avenue. So the decision was made that, well, why don't we just go out there, you know, by the tower. We'll be out of town. There's nothing out there. Nobody's out there but us. So that's what they did. And of course now everybody's out there, you know, houses and businesses all around the radio station out there. So that's why they moved out there, and that was in 1970.
Do you know why the move from the hotel in the first place into the house? What would be the reason?
I really don't know, unless they just wanted more room. Because they probably didn't have much room upstairs if it was kind of a back room type thing. And we're talking really an antiquated equipment, you know. And if they wanted to get into some place where they could have a bigger console, more turntables, this type of thing, they just had to have a bigger place. So I'm guessing that's why they moved out there.
Now the house, did it have to be remodeled specifically to have...
Not really.
Did it have to have the glass... walls in the studio?
Just one for the studio, between the console, the control room, and the studio was the only glass wall that I remember. Just like a huge big picture window is all it was. And then we had two offices, a main office, and a restroom, and a transmitter room, and that was it. It wasn't very big.
Okay.
No bedrooms. No sleeping.
No sleeping? Tell me more about your position as assistant manager at the radio.
Okay. There wasn't really an awful lot involved in that, unless the manager was going to be gone somewhere. And I don't remember of having to make any major decisions as such. But that was the primary purpose, would be in case he was gone and something came up that I would have to make a decision on. But I don't think I ever had to really make any that I remember of. Mm-hmm. It must not have been very important.
Another thing that you discussed was convincing the advertisers downtown of how many listeners you had. How would you do that if there were no polls or...
Well, we did have printed matter. I mean, we hired an organization to come in and kind of check the community, and then they'd come out with printed material that you could take, a brochure type thing that you could take to the advertisers. And of course, most of them could tell by... But we really didn't have, as I remember, a problem trying to convince people to use radio advertising, because they knew it worked. It just depended on what they were selling, you know. Some things sell better than others. But we had people that had been on the air for years and years and just stayed with it, either sponsored programs or had what we call spot announcements, you know. But we never really had a problem that I remember of selling advertising.
Was there an awareness in the beginning days of radio of how did radio work?
I'm sure there was.
Or was it a confusion?
Oh, that's pretty hard to answer, because I really don't know. But I imagine in the early days, people probably just thought, well, what in the world is going to happen, you know? This radio thing, is it any good, you know? And then people are able to get bigger stations in here if they had the radio system they could pull in. But I think that if they were able to get into the bigger stations and monitor what was going on, like years and years ago, Jack Benny program, if you remember again, Molly, the big shows, and a lot of people were able to get those out of the bigger markets, the bigger radio stations that could send those out to the air. But I think eventually it just became a process. The people tried it, and if they got response to their commercials or the information, then they realized that it did work, you know. And it does, even today.
Were the ads cleared by the advertiser?
A lot of the times, yes. You'd get the advertising, get the information they wanted in their commercials, go back to the station, and either you or the copywriter would do the copy, type it up, and then we would take it to the advertiser. Or if it was going to be taped, then we'd tape it and then call them up on the telephone and play it over the phone for them so they would know what it was.
And what is a teletype?
Teletype is, well, it's a bona fide typewriter, of course, that was at that time it was put up with the telephone company hooking it up, because all the information came by telephone lines, and it was the news. It typed out the news, you know.
What did it look like?
It looked like a typewriter, actually. It just basically, that's what it was.
Okay. Well, how did it work as far as the paper physically coming out? Was it a big, long stretch of paper? Or?
Well, it was in a roll at first, and then they came out with box paper. But it would just start typing, and then you'd watch what it was doing, and if it was doing a local or a Northwest news, you'd tear it off as you wanted it, you know, maybe about the size of your paper there. What's that, 11 inches or something? Mm-hmm. And in sheets. And sometimes it'd come in like a special program. You'd wait for the whole thing to print out, and then you'd tear it off and then fold it up and save it. Yes.
Or did it come off in paragraphs? Or?
No, in paragraphs, but it just like you were typing a letter, you know, much the same thing. And then they'd separate the paragraphs by a few spaces. And it was usually double-spaced, so you could read it real easy.
So the paper would come out of a roll in a readable form, not in a little skinny strip of paper
You
had to piece together.
No. No, it came out on a solid sheet of paper.
Okay. How large were the rolls?
Oh, my goodness. Well, they would be about the size of a roll of toilet paper, only maybe 12 inches wide.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Another thing you mentioned that I wanted to bring up was New Day Enterprises.
Yes.
Can you tell me more about New Day Enterprises?
Well, they started out years and years and years ago, I think, as I remember, at the little log cabin down at the fairgrounds, which is still there. And then we moved up into where the old St. Joseph Hospital, where CHD is now located. We were in that area for a while. And then eventually we built the complex on Depot Street. And then since then, I think they now have 6 different homes, you know, for the clients to live in. And it's such a, as I mentioned before, an unbelievable organization, and how they can work with these developmentally handicapped people that are able to do things, but have never just been given a chance to do anything until New Day came along and now works with these people, and they're able to do things with their hands, and they can think. And
do you know how it was started?
Not really. That was before my time, and they really got started with it. I don't know what the impetus was to get it going. Mm-hmm. I just really don't know. I just know it's become a very big thing. It's a very special part of our community here.
Mm-hmm. Do you know how the name may have come about?
I don't know that either. It's always been called New Day, as I can remember.
Okay. And do you know how it was financed?
It's financed through, kind of state funding through into CHD, the local mental health department, and then part of our funding comes from them. And then, of course, then we have private contributors that donate.
And so what kind of people were involved with New Day Enterprises when you started?
Well, people that like to work with, now you mean the people that work there?
Both volunteers and the clients.
Yeah. And then the clients, as I say, are those that, for some reason or other, are developmentally handicapped. I'm reluctant to use the word mentally handicapped, because some of them really can think pretty good. They just are not able to physically do a lot of things. And I think probably their families initially would approach a New Day to see if they could get their son or daughter or whatever, you know, enrolled in New Day as to be part of their program. And then the people that work there are a very special type people that, of course, have some training. They'd have to have some training to work with these people. And they're paid staff. So they're just unusual people that can work with people like this, you know. It takes special kinds. And we're very fortunate here through the years that I was involved with it, that we had the people that could do that and do it well.
Is there anything else about the New Day Enterprises that you can think of?
Well, other than the fact that it just seems to get bigger and bigger, you know. I think the last I remember, they had 5 different homes here in the community where these people actually lived. And they have people that live with them 24 hours a day, staff, you know. But they have their own kitchens. They cook their own meals, or they're cooked for them. They have yards, and they're taken out in the community to go sightseeing. Some of them are taken to bowling, this type of thing, you know. They try to get these people as involved as they can in the community, because they were never before. You know, they just stayed at home, I guess, and didn't do anything. And there was no trained staff, other than their parents, to take care of them. So with New Day, they have a work activity center where they go down. They actually, during the day, they do projects with their hands and cut out things, build things. So they're just very active, you know. They're not just don't sit around and do nothing.
I want to talk about a couple of more businesses that maybe you were in that you could tell me a little more detail about what they looked like on the inside. One is the Trocadero.
Oh, okay.
Describe for me what the Trocadero was and what it looked like when you walked in the front door.
Well, the Trocadero, and I think the name probably came from tropics, because all I remember was palm trees and tropical settings as such, you know, in there. And that's the biggest thing. And of course they had a dance floor and a very fine dining area. It was another one of the special places to go. As I mentioned, the Sack Coffee Shop, but the Trocadero was a little fancier, you know, type thing. And they had really good food, excellent. But I just remember that whenever I think of the Trocadero, I think of palm trees.
Do you recall if that would have been wallpaper on the walls or?
No, actually, I think there actually were some imitation palm trees when you walked in the front door. Boy, we're going back a long ways here now. But that's what comes to mind with me, really. And I'm sure the wall decorations probably were, you know, South Seas, tropical type stuff, you know.
Do you recall any of the architectural details?
No, I don't, not really. They had just the tables, booths. I don't remember anything really outstanding. Okay. And of course, it was usually pretty dark in there, you know, mm-hmm. as most lounges are. Mm-hmm. So I never really saw it with the lights all turned on.
Can you tell me any more about Bernie's Jewelry?
Well, let's see. Lorne and Betty Hughes owned Bernie's Jewelry as long as I can remember, and they have since retired. But at the time, it, and I think up on the other corner, Lawrence's Jewelry, Jack and Donna Lawrence, I think at that time were the only two jewelry stores in town that I remember, and that, I guess that's about it. You know, they're just a typical jewelry store with all kinds of fancy jewelry, diamonds and all this good stuff, you know. But I do remember that with both Lauren and Betty at Bernie's Jewelry, and then Jack and Donna Lawrence up at the other corner, both very wonderful businesses for LeGrand, and were much needed in the community, you know.
Do you recall ever going inside Hot Lake Hotel?
Oh, yes. I remember, I can't remember, they were trying to do a little remodeling there, and they did have opened up part of it for dining. So we were out there once to go to dinner. And then later on, they wanted to kind of redo the hot water systems. And so they did do some tours where you could see where they actually had run the hot water through for the therapy or whatever you call it that they tried to do back in those days. But it was a very small tour. It was no big deal. And I don't remember much about it when way back when it was the big deal and the railroad actually stopped there. It was called the Mayo Clinic of the West, as I remember. But people would come out here to be treated with the hot mineral water and stuff, you know.
Do you recall what the rooms looked like? Did you see the rooms?
No, I didn't see any of the rooms, so I don't know. Never got that part.
Did it look the same on the outside as it does now?
Well, only better.
Only better?
Not near as many broken windows.
Okay.
No, and I remember the lily pad lake out in front, mm-hmm. which is all dried up now, but that had just millions and millions of lily pads in it, you know, so that was kind of neat.
Were there staircases in the hotel?
You know, I don't remember that. I'm sure there was. No, I don't remember
an elevator.
I don't remember an elevator, but I'm sure there were stairways.